You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott, and welcome, everybody. On this Friday, the sell-off is continuing today with the Dow down almost 100 points right now, and stocks, in fact, are on pace for their worst weekly decline in 8 weeks now. Why? Increasing China tensions, especially this morning. We'll talk more about that. Some weak economic data weighing on sentiment today. Take a look at oil, though. It's rallying, and it's nearing the $30 mark. The June contract expires on Tuesday, so we're going to expect a lot of volatility going into that. On the economic front, as mentioned, retail sales plunged 16% in April, way worse than expected. Industrial production also sinking, down about 11%. There was a bright spot, though. Consumer sentiment surprisingly picked up in early May, came in better than expected. Gives us maybe some more insight into what the psyche of the consumer is right now. But let's get more on the psyche of these markets, and we go to Dom Chu for that. Dom?
All right, so Kelly, let's put some numbers to those themes that you were just talking about in the opening. Now, take a look at the Dow, the S&P, and NASDAQ. It's been generally a negative session today, but we're hovering in the middle of that session. At the highs, the Dow Industrials were up 27 points. At the lows, they were down 271. On a percentage basis, the S&P 500 currently off just 0.2%. The NASDAQ barely in the green at this point. Now, take a look at the sectors, because it's, again, a mixed picture. Materials, consumer staples, and energy, a mix of defensive and cyclical sectors leading the way higher. Meanwhile, you've got financials, real estate, and utilities, another mix really lagging so far today. Now, as for some of the stocks on the move today, we will talk about some of those themes you just mentioned. Check out shares of Qualcomm. Those renewed tensions with China. Could there be retaliation? Could companies like Qualcomm, other chip stocks, be beneficiaries or be hurt because of it? That's a big theme developing. Also, what's happening with Nordstrom, a reversal in retail stocks after the worst print for retail sales on record. So watch that. It could be fundamental buying or short covering. And then one last one here, McCormick, the spice maker. New all-time high today. Just tells you how much people are staying at home and cooking at home with those spices. Back over to you, Kelly.
What was your brand, Dom? Your favorite brand?
So my father-in-law loves Penzi's spices. So between McCormick and Penzi's, we've got the spice rack covered in those two brands.
Italian seasoning. That's my new. I never knew.
I've also started an herb garden. Yes. And I'm going to get some tips from you, Kelly, after the show.
If I could grow basil, anyone can. Anyway, let's move on. Dom, thanks. The recovery rally is grinding to a halt, as he just outlined. The Dow and the S&P are down about 3% this week, while the NASDAQ is down about 2%. For more on all this, I'm joined by Jason Trenert, the chairman and CEO of Strategus Research Partners, and Bob Michael is head of global fixed income strategy for JP Morgan Asset Management. It's great to have you both here. Jason, I'll just start with you because you're saying there's five things really that could cause a sell-off from here, and a couple of them certainly grab my attention. Run through them if you don't mind real quickly.
Well, listen, I think the most important one over time is just simply time. And I think one of the things we've looked at when we've talked to our clients is that there's been this difference, obviously, between the performance of the economy and the markets. And I understand people's hesitancy there, but by the same token, you usually don't have bear markets, in my opinion, that are associated with recessions that only last 1 month. And that's what we saw from February into March. So the most important one of the five would be time. Then you have things like political wrangling, negative interest rates. Those would be some of the other things that we would look at that, in my opinion, could set about a catalyst for a new decline in the markets.
Right. So worsening on the health front, you know, political wrangling over stimulus, I get those too. But you also say the return of corporate guidance could cause a market sell-off. Negative interest rates, as you said, I'd like to hear why you think that would cause a market sell-off. And a Democratic sweep come November, you don't have to get too political about it. But what is it in particular about guidance and rates that you're concerned about?
Well, I think as far as guidance is concerned, right now, you know, it's usually a little bit of art and science coming up with an earnings number as a strategist. And right now it's like modern art, you know, or abstract art, because there's no idea. You have nothing to go on. I think in some ways people are giving companies as a result the benefit of the doubt and thinking that things are going to get better as the economy reopens, which is almost inevitable. Whether it's sustainable is another question. I think if companies really start making longer term guidance that says, no, this is the real thing, this is going to take us some time to get through, that could be a problem. Negative rates, in my opinion, have been tried in Europe and Japan and have largely been a disaster. I think there are benefits to it, but most of the benefits are greatly outweighed by its negative impact on the banking system, which is really the oxygen upon which most economies breed. So I think that would be a bad idea. I think the Fed's done all that it can do, or it may do a little bit more in terms of expanding the balance sheet, but negative interest rates, in my opinion, would be a bridge too far.
Well, let's bring in Bob on that very point. Bob, of all the questions I thought you were going to be reflecting, is the bond market dead, was not the main one. What made that kind of come up in conversation with clients in terms of what you see happening in the market, and what do we need to be concerned about?
Well, I think that a lot of clients are concerned that as the central banks are buying greater and greater parts of the bond markets, it starts with government bonds in the U.S. It's gone to agency mortgages. In Europe, it's gone to corporates. It's now corporates. In the U.S., there's a sense that they're squeezing out the potential bond investor and bringing yields down to an abnormally low level. I think what they're forgetting is we're going to see an extreme amount of issuance. We're going to see trillions of dollars of government debt. Already this year, we've seen $1 trillion of corporate debt issued. There's going to be plenty for everyone to buy, and you have to think of it as co-investing with the Fed to help the recovery along.
Yeah, it's a point in terms of whether those purchases would kind of crowd out the private sector, so to speak, that some of the bears have emphasized. I believe Stan Druckenmiller might be one of them who's kind of concerned about where all of this borrowing and buying is going. It's interesting, too, the people are worried about rates being artificially low when it sounds like they're trying to kind of continue to push them lower. Maybe putting all of that aside, what's your point of view on how low rates can go? I mean, does the Fed even need to go negative in order for large parts of the Treasury curve to go negative, corporate borrowing to go negative? We've certainly seen, people even issuing debt at negative rates, European issuers and so forth. We've seen that already.
Well, I know last July when I said I expected the 10-year Treasury to go to zero, you thought I was crazy. let me tell you that when I heard Jay Powell talk about negative rates and he said, not for now, that for now even caused me to gasp.
Really?
Because once you fall into that negative hole, nobody's been able to get out. No economy in Europe and certainly not in Japan. So I hope they stay at zero. They need to create an affordable funding environment for all levels of government, for all businesses, and for households to be able to finance themselves. I think Jay Powell called it a bridge for now. And I think the Fed has shown from 2015 to 2018 that they can normalize policy when the time is appropriate.
So in other words, Bob, you heard him say not now, and also read that, as many did, as saying, hey, the door is open. Let me just ask you, for those who say, well, you work at J.P. Morgan, of course you don't want negative rates. Explain why that would be bad for the whole public, not just for the big banks.
Well, it's bad for savers, and there are so many savers in the economy that have money on deposit. If you look at money market assets, they keep setting a record high every day. So if you take rates to negative, do you just cap people off at zero? And if you take rates to negative, then you're going to bring bond market yields down towards zero and negative as well. So you tend to penalize savers quite a bit. And we know there are about 10,000 retirees, new retirees every day in the U.S. who need some form of fixed income.
Yeah.
Positive fixed income.
Right, exactly. Not negative fixed income. Jason, I'll just give you the final word here to kind of bring this back to the stock market. You guys have moved your investments kind of away from cyclicals, more into technology and communications. And when I saw that, I just wondered about if you're, chasing the consensus, so to speak.
Well, there may be a sense in which we're doing that, but I also think it has a lot to do with the length of time I think it will take for us to get back to the level of economic activity. It really has a lot to do with what I see as the shape of the recovery, which is to say, I think growth is going to be impaired for a long period of time. I think the black swan wasn't necessarily the virus. It was the lockdown. We've done a lot of damage to the economy that will take a long time to repair. And I think in that environment, people are going to pay up for growth stocks. And I came into this year, I have to say, very bullish on cyclicals and value oriented stocks. And that was largely because I thought with the trade war dormant, you would have a stronger year for global growth. Mm. And, we'll never know whether that would have been correct or not because of the virus and the lockdown. But as it stands now, I think, again, unfortunately, I think this will take some time to repair. As a result, I want to be more more in the growth orientation as it stands now.
Understood. Great chat, guys. Thank you both. Appreciate it. Jason Chenard and Bob Michael joining me today. We have some breaking news out of the oil patch. And remember, WTI had been pretty, you know, rallying pretty nicely today, but the rig counts are out for the week. Brian Sullivan has the numbers. Brian?
I'll tell you what hasn't been rallying, Kelly, and that is the number of drilling rigs. They fell again. Oil drilling rigs, according to Baker Hughes, dropping another 34. We're at like 285 now on the oil rig side, 300 and change for total rigs. That includes gas and offshore. I can't express to you the significance, Kelly, of the rapidity of the drop in new drilling rigs. You go back to 2010, I just did before coming on air. We were at 1,400. Now we're at a couple hundred, and that's because of this. Look at that. These are fracking operations as measured by Rystad Energy. In January, everything's humming. The economy's going great. 1,158 operations for new fracked wells. It went up in February. March, we start to fall. April dropped off. Look at that. So far in May, Kelly, according to Rystad Energy, we're at 92, down from 1,158. Now, these are jobs as well, and I think that's key. It goes to industrial production. You're not drilling a well. You don't need the well pipe. You don't need the workers. You don't need the support crews. You don't need the truck drivers as well. So the rig count's dropping. In fact, I'm trying to find a lower number. I'm kind of rapidly going through the spreadsheets back years. And right now, I can't. This could be nearly at least a multi-decade low for the number of operational rigs, Kelly.
And it's, so just to be clear, you're saying we had like 1,400 back in 2010 and 92 last month. Is that new wells or that's just any well in operation? I mean, that's a staggering decline.
Well, 92 is the number of fracked operations, the number of sort of different things, not just wells, the number of companies that are drilling wells and whatever sort of process. Yeah, you can go back to 1,500 back in 2010 when oil was coming off that peak. Of course, that's probably the problem. That's how we got the 13 million barrels a day. That's how we're having some issues now with production. I will say this. You wonder what's going on. If we look at the multi-month contracts, we're pretty much, I'm going to get a little fancy for you, Kelly, and I apologize. I'm going to say something I thought I'd never say on TV. It's backwardation, okay?
That's not that
fancy.
That's
the opposite of, thank you. Good. That's the FCC is not getting involved. That's the opposite of contango. That means prices today in the future actually went lower than the current price. That's really bad news if you paid a couple million dollars to store your oil offshore. Demand has been up. People are driving again. Production down 17 million barrels a day globally, according to OPEC. That's why prices have firmed up.
No backwardation from Brian Sullivan. Thank you, sir. We appreciate it.
Oh, by the way, can I jump in? One quick thing.
Sure.
I heard your comment with Dom. Best hot sauce in America. I have no affiliation with it. Secret Aardvark out of Portland, Oregon. Don't know the guys. Whoever they are, they're amazing. Check it out.
All right. We're going to collect
weekend.
These tips all show. Brian, thanks very much. Coming up, we're going to take a quick break first, though, and talk about MasterCard when we come back. They say we're moving into the normalization phase of credit card use. Is now the time to buy the sector? We'll debate that. Plus, 23andMe is working to find out why some people are getting sicker than others when it comes to COVID-19. The CEO joins us with a look at how they're figuring this out and the progress they've made so far. Much more coming up on The Exchange. Welcome back. Credit card stock staged a big rally this week when MasterCard says it's seen a slight rebound in credit card use over the past 2 weeks, in part due to the reopening of several states. But even if the worst is behind us, what does the new normal look like for consumer spending and for these stocks? For more, I'm joined by Lisa Ellis, a partner at MoffittNathanson, and Chris Donat, who is senior analyst at Piper Sandler. Great to have you both back and to check in. Chris, I actually want to start with you and the optimism you see on shares of American Express. It's interesting to me that Amex is still down 30% on a one-year basis. But Visa and MasterCard are actually up about 11%. So what is it about Amex to you, which I think would be really, really hit by the drop in travel and corporate expenses, that has you attracted here?
Yeah, so you're right. There is a hit to Amex from a drop in what they call, T&E, travel and entertainment, represents about 20% of the spending for them. What I think is an offset to that one or diminishes sort of the impact is the amount of revenue that American Express generates from the transactional part of the card business. It's only about half of the revenue for the total company. They're still going to make money on net interest income, and card fees and a bunch of other sources that are much more steady. So yes, there's a hit, but I think it's relatively small. And at this point, we're guardedly optimistic about how credit quality will perform them for them. There's a lot of noise actually around the new CECL accounting standard and what that means for near term earnings. But anyway, I think for the out year forecast, you can have some optimism that the credit quality issues will stabilize and the amount of provisioning they will stabilize too.
Yeah, and I know you're still bearish on MasterCard, you know, still concerned about a lot of that cross-border activity that they're losing, neutral on Visa. Lisa, you're more constructive on those names and especially on PayPal. And here's my question. So many people emphasize PayPal winning in online commerce, but it uses, I mean, certainly my user experience now is it uses Visa and MasterCard. You know, I know there's ways around it, but I wonder if most, so are they all just winning together now? I mean, can you explain a little bit how this trade works?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they are all winning together. So you're right. The majority of transactions through PayPal are funded by a card. And so But PayPal is making a spread on those transactions as well, as are the card networks. So they all benefit. The difference there is that PayPal is all e-commerce, which, of course, is seeing an enormous secular uptick as a result of the pandemic with people all sheltering in place. Their numbers were the biggest positive surprise, in our view, out of the whole earnings cycle these last few weeks. For example, they posted 43% growth in their checkout volumes in April. That's more than double the rate in February. So you're starting to see this really sharp uptake in e-commerce volumes as people are buying more things online.
It's amazing. I can't even stay logged in. I mean, I try to use PayPal and Venmo, and I always get kicked out. Chris, what about the levels of consumer spending? What is the new normal you think going to look like? So understandably, we're starting to come back, starting the normalization process. But where are we going?
Yeah, I think the new normal is certainly going to be lower than where we were. And some of my colleagues at Piper Sandler have done some nice work with doing consumer surveys. And you're showing consumers are cautious in what they're thinking about spending. So I think you'll see some help in the United States from the stimulus checks. But you have to ask yourself, what does the spending environment look like after the stimulus checks? When people are, you know, if unemployment is still elevated, people are going to, I think, be kind of cautious on their spending, which does weigh on overall spending activity on Visa and MasterCard and everyone else in the payment sector.
At least I'll give you the final response to that. You know, PayPal as well is a stock that is up 30% on the year, so certainly hasn't suffered during the pandemic. But how much do you think people are pricing in, whether for them, for the traditional cards, a V-shaped recovery, a swoosh? I mean, what's in the cards right now?
Yeah, right now I'd say that as much as it's clearly completely uncertain and no one really knows, at this point it's more of the swoosh style, sort of slow, steady improvement. I mean, we saw MasterCard's new numbers they just released yesterday for May, and the U.S. numbers are at least looking a lot better. U.S. is currently running down 6 year to year in the beginning of May. Just to put a reference point on that, it was down almost 20 in April. Wow. And if it gets back to about zero, that's about where we were in the financial crisis. So just if folks that, you know, are kind of trying to make sense of what to think about these numbers, what we're aiming for is we'd ideally at least like to get back to a flat year-on-year number that's comparable to 2009, 2010. That's certainly what we've got baked into our outlooks for Visa, MasterCard, PayPal. Anything better than that would be upside. And I think, you know, that's kind of what we're hoping for. And honestly, that negative 6 number already in May was a positive surprise yesterday from MasterCard.
But still, I mean, to hear that zero is only, you know, getting us back to 08, 09, it's really interesting. Thank you both. It's good to check in again. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Lisa Ellis and Chris Donat talking about the card stocks and about spending overall. Coming up, maybe it's in the genes. 23andMe is recruiting more patients as it expands its DNA study to see why some are at greater risk for COVID-19 than others. We're going to speak with the CEO about that next. Plus, Washington wants socially distant airplanes. Great for passengers, but could the airlines survive under these new rules? We'll break that down. Remember, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. The Exchange is back in a couple. Welcome back now to the very latest in the coronavirus pandemic. Over to Sue Herrera for that. Sue?
Thank you very much, Kelly. Good afternoon, everyone. As some parts of New York begin reopening today, Governor Andrew Cuomo is extending restrictions for the rest of that state until May 28th. He also announced four states are coordinating efforts to let people back on the beach.
The agreement is New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Delaware will all be opening beaches for the Memorial Day weekend. States will have different specific rules about what happens on that beach. They'll all be plus or minus, but they're all basically in the same ballpark.
The Navy hospital ship USNS Mercy has left Los Angeles today, though 60 medical staff will remain in that area to help at local nursing facilities. The ship was sent to Los Angeles in late March to help treat non-coronavirus patients, although only ended up treating 77 patients. As always, you can get more on our coronavirus coverage by going to CNBC.com. Kelly, back to you.
All right, Sue, thanks very much. There's still so much we don't know about COVID-19, including what role genetics may be playing and how severely someone gets infected. Meg Terrell joins me now with more on that and a special guest. Meg?
Hey, Kelly. Well, there are some things we do know about the risk of severe disease with COVID-19. Of course, that it increases with age and with underlying conditions. But there are also instances where it seems to strike people who are seemingly very healthy and young. For example, NBC contributor Dr. Joseph Fair, who tweeted a photo this week of his recovery from COVID-19. And in a story about him, NBC reports he's a seemingly healthy 42-year-old who's running 5 to 10 miles a day. And still, there he is in recovery at the hospital. So a lot of groups are looking into what might be driving that, why some people are asymptomatic and others are hit so hard. And they think genetics may play a role. 23andMe is one of those groups. They started a study and now have enrolled more than 500,000 people, 7,000 of whom have had COVID-19. And this week, they extended that study to try to focus specifically on people who've been hospitalized with COVID-19. And they're giving away 10,000 free test kits, the genetic test kits, that is, to try to enroll those folks. So joining us now to talk about that effort is 23andMe CEO Ann Wojcicki. Ann, it's great to see you. Thanks for being with us. Tell us about this test. And you started it about a month ago. You're expanding it now. When do you expect to get results?
Yeah, we started it April 6th, and we offered just to 23andMe customers to say, have you, you know, if you've been exposed or if you want to take the survey to take the 23andMe COVID-19 survey. We got 500,000 people to actually fill out that survey. Almost 8,000 people now actually have said that they have had COVID-19. And because we were rushing to see, can we make a discovery, we decided yesterday, a couple days ago, that we wanted to give out 10,000 kits to anyone who said that they've been hospitalized with COVID-19. And we're really looking to see, are there genetics about susceptibility? So why some people are getting it, and severity. Some people are just super sick. And we're hoping to see, can we find something, and can we find something quickly?
And in your announcement about the study, you mentioned that previous studies have shown that there is some interplay of genetics in terms of susceptibility for other infectious diseases. Tell us about just what the precedent is for seeing the genetics role in these kinds of things, and whether we've seen studies that have shown any influence of genetics on the severity of infectious disease.
Yeah, we actually, there's a couple that are good examples. So norovirus is one where you hear about that sometimes, the cruise ship virus, where there's roughly 20% of the population actually is resistant to that. HIV is another one where there's a well-known mutation called CCR5, and people who have that mutation are actually resistant to HIV. So we published a paper. We started doing research on infectious diseases. We published a paper a couple of years ago actually looking at our customers and a number of diseases like measles. And it gives us optimism that we actually have a good chance of finding something that will show why some people have a more severe case and why some people are more susceptible than others.
You also noted in your post about expanding the study to folks who are in the hospital that, of course, it is a sensitive situation. Many people are still recovering. How are you handling that kind of outreach? Are you partnering with academic medical centers, with hospitals? How will you find these folks and get the kits to them?
A lot of what we're hoping, because you're right, a lot of people are going to be in the hospital. So we're hoping that family members will be able to, take advantage of this and then find, you know, when people are out of the hospital, that then they'll be able to help them enroll. We're absolutely interested in partnering with hospitals and academic centers, pretty much anyone who can actually help find the answers here. I feel like this is really, in some ways, like this is something that has pulled together the entire scientific community, and there's a lot of collaboration happening right now, and we want to just do whatever we can to help. So a couple academic groups have reached out to us, some of the cities with real hotspots. So for instance, New York, there's a number of sequencing programs underway. We are committed to publishing our data and collaborating with any other group that's out there that wants to be able to pull data together to see, you know, can we find something?
And you clearly have a lot of participants already. You know, 500,000 people have opted in. But we have been hearing over the past few quarters, you know, from companies like Illumina, which provide the sequencers that do the sequencing, that direct-to-consumer genetics has kind of been on a downturn. Fewer people are getting these kits. Is that something you've observed? What are the most recent trends on how interested people are in this?
A couple interesting things have happened. There was absolutely a slowing of the market compared to 2018. 17 and 18, you had this explosion where people were just so interested in their genetics and rushing. And I think that you had a number of different factors that played in last year where people want to understand privacy and just understand how their information is being used. And so we've always been very transparent with our customers, and it's always been a big priority for us to make sure people know exactly what they are getting and that they have this opportunity to opt in to research or opt into DNA relatives. So what we've seen since COVID-19 is that there was an initial hit to sales, but it's really come back. And I think that comes from the fact that people realize we're likely to be home for a while. The medical system has changed. You're not running into the doctor's office for routine care, and that it's really important to understand how you can take care of yourself at home. And a good part of what 23andMe does is it gives people information about risks. So what is it that's in your DNA that you're potentially at higher risk for, something like type 2 diabetes? And now, is there an opportunity for you to change your behavior and actually change, and prevent a disease? And I think you see a lot of people these days who are interested, more interested than they were in the past, in preventing a disease, right, because they want to really stay out of the hospital for good reason.
Yeah, medicine sure is changing with this. Anne Wojcicki, thank you so much for being with us today. We're eager to hear about the results of your study. Kelly, back to you.
And Meg, thank you. Really appreciate it. Great to hear from her. Anne Wojcicki. Coming up, 16 office towers with 10 million square feet. That's just a sampling of how much real estate Rudin Management has under its belt. We're going to speak with the CEO, Bill Rudin, about the state of the market and what the office building of the future will look like right after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. A quick check on the markets right now. We're way off the lows when the Dow was down 270 points. It's only down 38 right now. The S&P is down 3 points, and the Nasdaq is positive by 11. Remember, this is still against the backdrop of a pretty rough week, the worst in a few months. Here's your sectors. Leading the way today are consumer staples and materials, interestingly. Utilities and real estate are the laggards. Real estate just can't catch a break these days. And speaking of which, it's 10 million square feet, 18 luxury apartment buildings, and 16 office towers. That's just some of the properties that our next guest manages in New York. As areas of the state begin to open, how will commercial buildings make their tenants feel safe? And how different will the office tower be after this pandemic? For more on the path forward for real estate, I'm joined by Bill Rudin. He is the CEO of Rudin Management. Bill, it's great
to have you.
Welcome.
Thanks, Kelly. Thanks for having me on.
Must be a very, very anxious time for you.
Well, it's been, it's been very interesting. You mentioned the state, New York State, starting to reopen. The governor is slowly opening the door. He's done an amazing job in communicating and making sure we get through this very difficult period of time. And, you know, obviously we've been working on all levels of government, trying to be as helpful as we can to make sure that when New York City starts to reopen, that our customers and our tenants are safe and they feel comfortable coming back into the work environment.
And we'll talk about some of the technology in particular that you and others are going to be using. But I want to talk big picture for a moment. You know, Nielsen is one of the companies who has said, and this was in the New York Times the other day, that even after coronavirus, there are 3,000 workers in the city no longer need to be the office full time, can work from home most of the week. And their larger point was that Manhattan faces a reckoning if working from home becomes the norm. You know, there is a sea change. Even just yesterday, the CEO of Scotts Miracle-Gro said, yeah, I used to commute from New York to Ohio every day. I'm not going to be doing that anymore. What happens if people's behaviors change and they don't need as much commercial space as they used to?
Well, first of all, you had your guest on before about research and science, and I think there's been reports about vaccines coming on the market sooner rather than later, which is a very helpful sign, therapies. So it is people working from home has adapted very quickly, but I think New York City has always come back from these type of situations in the early 90s. We had 30 million feet of vacant space in Lower Manhattan. Everybody said it wasn't going to come back. After 9/11, nobody was going to come back into an office building. Everyone was going to work below the 15th floor after Sandy. So, you know, the obituary of New York has been written many times. But, you know, we're confident with proper protocols, great leadership from our mayor and our governor, and the social human interaction that has always been part of the strength of New York City will come back. It's going to take a little time after all these other situations, but it will come back. And there will be other companies that will step into the void as some companies continue to work from home. We've got incredible research hospitals. We've got scientists. We've got medical institutions. They're going to grow. Other companies will step in. And use technology to be creative and be the companies of the future that we hope will fill in our spaces.
Yeah. So let's talk. Speaking of technology, there's several things you guys are doing to kind of get through the next 3 to 6 to 12 to maybe 24 months. You have a tech startup subsidiary. You have a Nantum building operating system that tracks indoor air quality metrics, temperatures. You can expand it to things related to health and wellness. You have an app that provides situational awareness, so to speak, to tenants so they can see how crowded spaces like the lobby and other rooms are. Are there waiting lines to the elevators? You know, it reminds me of the SimCity game I played as a kid.
Well, my son, who's 35 years old, he grew up on SimCity also. But I'm going to hire you as our salesperson because you pitched it perfectly. We started this prescriptive data a few years ago to make our buildings more environmentally friendly, more operationally functional. It gives real-time data to our building operations team. And so trying to create this app and give our tenants real-time data is a continuum of this technology.
Yeah.
So we've been working on this for a while. We understand how many people are in the building, what the CO2 levels are, what water consumption, electrical consumption is. So it's really the building operating system of the future. And we've been licensing it to other building owners and corporations literally all over the country.
Could be a whole new business model. No, I mean, frankly, I find it on some level kind of creepy, but I understand that, you know, people want, as long as it's anonymized, I guess that, you know, it's useful information to have. Real quickly, Bill, before you go, Danny Meyer has been talking about not reopening his restaurants because the level of demand is simply not coming back in the foreseeable future. Does something like that send more of a chill down your spine, the sense that, you know, hey, these are the big players that should be stepping up right now?
Well, look, Danny is a great friend. Actually, we're having him operate our food service in our new building in Brooklyn at Dock 72. But I think it's really, it's been a lot of discussion about state and city funding. And I think the House today, hopefully, or Monday will pass their COVID-4 stimulus bill, which has over $750 billion, that's with a B, dollars for cities and states all over the country. It's just not about New York. New York State is 8% of the GDP. New York City is 5%. So we need, not just us, but every city across the country needs that stimulus dollars to get funneled back into the city. We've taken tremendous hits on city revenues, transfer tax, income tax. So we need that revenue to get back in there and support our basic functions. And I think, restaurants, a local restaurant that my wife and I go to, there I spoke to the owner and he said, I said, how are you going to adapt to the 30%? He goes, I'm going to have a seating at 5. I'm going to have a seating at 6. I'm going to have a seating at 7. And a seating at 8. So we have to adapt and make changes. And hopefully we'll transition through, get to the point where the vaccines and therapies are out there and the city will be back better and stronger. My dad always said, never bet against New York City. So we're continuing that.
That's for sure. No, I know exactly what you're saying. Bill, thanks for joining me today and good luck with it. Please keep us posted.
Thanks, Kelly.
Bill Rudin is the CEO of Rudin Management. Got some 13F headlines out right now from Tiger Global. Dom Chu has those for us. Dom?
All right. The notable tech-oriented hedge fund founded by Chase Coleman, one of the Tiger Cubs, so to speak. Some interesting highlights here include a new stake in online exercise and streaming equipment maker Peloton, a new stake there. Also, a decrease in their stake in Uber by just around 54%. So possibly some coronavirus-related plays there. Also, a large increase in shares of Salesforce on the cloud side of things, as well as a total sellout of Slack. And massive increases in shares of Workday and Datadog. So, again, on that software kind of cloud play type situation as well, we're seeing some of those play out. Also, checking out what's happening else with other parts of the market, but we'll continue to dig through these, Kelly, but some big deals. And remember, Kelly, these are as of the end of March, so there's a big data lag here on these particular numbers. Back over to you.
All right, Dom, thank you. Dominic Chu. Still ahead, the chip stocks are getting hit as U.S. tensions with China flare, this time with the administration blocking shipments of semiconductors to Huawei. What's at stake in this battle is next here on The Exchange. Welcome back. Take a look at the semiconductors today. The ETF tracking them down about 3% right now and on pace for its worst week since mid-March. The White House is looking to cut Huawei off from its U.S. chip suppliers, which includes Xilinx, NVIDIA and Intel. The U.S. is also now bracing for possible retaliation from China by activating its unreliable entity list. Now, this comes as Taiwan Semiconductor, an Apple supplier, has just announced plans to build a $12 billion plant here in the U.S. Let's talk about all of it and the impact on the industry with John Fort. John, a lot to kind of unpack here and some fast-moving developments. The one thing, the impression that I came away with in reading this is that while I understand the imperative to get, some of the semiconductor supply chain into the U.S., it sounds like the U.S. semiconductor companies feel like they might be at a disadvantage competitively. I mean, can you unpackage all of this?
Well, where should we start? You're absolutely right. These two headlines are kind of at odds with one another because a fab, a chip manufacturing plant, is unique in that it costs billions and billions of dollars to make. It takes years to make one, and pretty much as soon as you build it, it's almost obsolete, right? They're building, TSMC is building this one in Arizona on the 5-nanometer process. By the time this is built around 2024, they're estimating they'll probably be pretty close to moving to even more advanced processes. So when you're building something like this, you really want stability. You want regulatory stability. You want a tax runway that you can really see and understand. And you want to be able to export the product in there anywhere in the world because assembly really could happen anywhere. You don't know exactly necessarily who your customer is going to be in 4 years. Well, the regulatory things that the U.S. is talking about with Huawei right now, which is the biggest customer in one of the fastest growing economies on the planet, that works against the certainty that TSMC would want. So you have to wonder what kind of guarantees or incentives they got to commit to building this.
Let me kind of ask it from this point of view. What does this all mean for Intel? Now, Intel had just said it was potentially working on having a plant here in the U.S., maybe one to supply the Pentagon. So I see the big picture. It's moved more of the chip supply chain into the U.S. and put, you know, maybe lessen its reliance on China in particular. But what's it all mean for Intel?
Well, Intel already has, by my count, around 11 chip fabs in the U.S., 4 already in Arizona. So it's not as if Intel is new to this game. I think the question is more, will the incentive picture change for Intel to expand what it has already or build new in the U.S.? And I think part of that is the regulatory picture. Who gets exceptions from some of the regulations that are coming out? What kind of certainty can the government provide to individual companies, even if they're trying to provide some barriers or negotiating room with China?
Right, exactly. No, it's tricky. Again, a lot of big picture stuff underway here, but the stock's obviously reacting a little bit concerned about it. John, thanks. We appreciate it. John Fort with the latest today. Meanwhile, nearly a third of U.S. colleges and universities are at least considering keeping most of their classes online this fall. Those are the latest figures from the Chronicle of Higher Education. That has lots of students and their families rethinking things as well. Some are even going to court. Scott Cohn is live with more. Scott?
Hi, Kelly. We are at San Jose State University. There's my Spartan blue. This is one of the 23 Cal State campuses that have just announced that they will stay basically virtual for the fall, but no break in the tuition, and the university is even refusing to refund some fees for things like the student center and health care. That is infuriating to some students, like Sonoma State biology major Michaela Miller, who says she's out about $1,000.
It's not fair for them to treat us like this. We signed a contract that said we would pay if they would provide us with certain services, and they're not holding up their end.
So Miller has joined a proposed class action suit. The university says it's still providing services, albeit some of them remotely, and it will vigorously defend the case. Similar story in Florida at the University of Florida, where Anthony Rojas is a grad student.
The idea behind it is if you are going to charge someone for physical service, you no longer can provide it, we believe that students should get a refund.
But the university president says that is not exactly the point.
Granted, many of them didn't have the full access to those student services, but what we did was commit to the students that we would provide for them a rich experience with additional expenses that we took on through the online experience.
Now, there is also a separate group of lawsuits that is actually asking universities to give back some of the tuition to make up for the switch to online learning, but some legal experts say those may be a little tougher to prove. Kelly?
Scott, I'm surprised that so many are still trying to have virtual classes. It seems like they might be setting themselves way back if they do. That a lot of students, from what I hear anecdotally, are either going to defer or go to some place that is open.
That's right. I mean, there is a lot of interest in this whole idea of a gap year. There's actually a group called the Gap Year Association. They say that their web traffic in recent weeks has quadrupled. And there's some talk that there's about 40,000 or so students took a gap year this year. It could be hundreds of thousands next year. And that increases the financial uncertainty for all of these colleges and universities.
Absolutely does. Scott, thanks very much. Our Scott Cohn. Okay. Still ahead, Congress wants to do away with the middle seat. But setting up truly social distant airplanes could be devastating for the industry. We're going to dig into the numbers next. Coming up on Power Lunch, chef and restaurateur Tim Love is back. He'll have his outlook for restaurants as his spots in Texas have been open for 2 weeks now with some surprising results. Don't miss it. Welcome back. The pain keeps coming for the airline stocks. This week alone, shares of United and Delta are down double digits again, and American and Southwest are close behind. This is on top of huge losses for the year. And now there's a fight between the travel industry and Washington over whether or not they can mandate airlines to operate at 60% capacity. That would basically push the airlines to keep the middle seat open, something customers and Congress want. But is it feasible? Let's ask Seth Kaplan. He's airline analyst and principal with Kaplan Research. And our own Philip Bowe is here as well. Seth, I'll start with you and congrats on Kaplan Research. I mean, you do a podcast with Ben Baldanza that airlines come. You're a very busy man. You know this through and through, just like Phil here. So what do you think? I mean, can they be mandated to cut back? And why wouldn't they have to if that's simply what the flyers want?
Yeah, and Kelly, you're right. I never imagined that airlines would practically stop flying and there would be so much to talk about, right? But the issue here is that one of the strongest relationships in all of airline economics is the relationship between how many seats you pack on the plane and the unit cost, the cost of carrying each seat each mile. And for all of the more noticed things that airlines have done in recent years to cut costs, really one of the less sexy but most important ones they've done is pack those seats on the plane. And then there's a relationship, obviously, between their costs and airfares. So if you're basically going to force them to reduce capacity, you're going to push their costs up and push the cost of flying up. So then it basically becomes value judgment, right? You know, we can't have people 6 feet apart from each other on an airplane. Is 18 inches better than nothing at all? I don't know. Yeah, I'd probably rather have 18 inches rather than nothing at all. Probably rather have 100 people on a plane instead of 150. But am I willing to pay as much more as it would cost to do that? Different people have different answers.
Well, and Phil, it means that the people, you know, at the bottom of the income chain are going to drop out. So in other words, it's making flying more expensive, making it more of a luxury, you know, product again. And I guess I go back to whether or not it's mandated. Is the idea that we have to protect flyers from themselves, that people would go ahead and pack on these planes if Congress doesn't mandate this?
That is partially the idea, Kelly. Look, people will continue to fly, more people will, and as that happens, will we be back to the levels we were last year? Let me show you a typical 737. Last year, 84.4% of the seats on a typical 737 were filled. So you had a smattering of empty seats on most flights. This is what Representative Peter DeFazio, who runs the Transportation Committee, is proposing. He says, do not book the middle row. The airline should not do that. And they should limit capacity to 67% of the seats being filled. By the way, that means you'd get about 18 inches of elbow room with the person next to you. That's not socially distant.
Exactly.
And there are even a few people who are saying, hey, it should be true social distancing on a plane. Let me give you some perspective on what that would mean. On a typical 737, you might get 20 passengers in economy and four in business class. That is an unsustainable business model, would never fly in the industry. Airlines would say, no, we'll go bankrupt before we do that. It's not that they don't care about the safety of passengers. It's that this is an industry that is built on the idea you put as many people on the plane as possible. You need that volume in order to earn a profit.
Right. And I guess, Seth, I'm interested in what this is telling us about how we're actually all responding to coronavirus. The idea, as Phil said, if you can really only fit 20 people on a plane with social distancing and they're all using recycled air anyway, I mean, the very act of getting on a plane is a pretty risky one. So it seems that the message is either people want to take that risk but should be discouraged from doing so. You know, I'm just trying to understand what, you know, kind of it seems to all be coming down to the airlines, but there's a lot of different things going on here.
Yeah, airlines, look, airplanes and airports were not designed for social distancing, were they? And yeah, with the lack of sort of national guidance with a lot of things right now, but certainly this, it is up to the airlines. We've seen them struggle with, you know, implementing mandatory masks and temperature checks and all the rest of it, and all of them come to different conclusions in some cases. But yeah, as Phil said, that math would take us way back in time, you know, to where flying would be a privilege. And I think we are at a point here where at some point here where the very most vulnerable people are just going to have to stay home, unfortunately, as the country begins to open up. And, you know, whether it would be safe for them to be on an airplane anyway, even at any price, a question. And if you can't answer that question, then you're trading that for the certainty of higher fares for everyone else.
Phil, I guess that's what I'm saying is I wonder if this is all just an exercise in making ourselves feel like we're doing something that is neither true social distancing nor barring airlines from flying.
Well, I think you're right, Kelly. And look, these airlines, they need to put as many people on these planes as possible. And so if you force them to keep the middle seat open, can they do it? Yes. Will they raise fares? You bet they will. And then you'll have people complaining, well, the airfares have gone up. They're up 40% or 35% compared to where they were last year. Why are they doing this? It's pretty simple. These airlines are paid to transport you and I from point A to point B, and there is a cost involved. They need to at least make that cost. And then hopefully, from their perspective, running a business, they turn a profit.
Yeah, it's going to be wild to see what happens here. I feel bad for everybody involved, up and down. Flyers, the airlines, the passengers, everybody. Seth Kaplan, Phil Lebeau, thanks. And we'll see where it goes from here, whether Congress does mandate something or not. And that does it for The Exchange today. Thanks so much for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.